It's good to see everyone this morning. Appreciate very much the presence of those who are visiting with us. We're delighted that you are here, and we hope that you'll stick around afterward. Let us talk with you a little bit more and get to know you a little bit more, but we're very glad that you have joined us this morning. Unless perhaps you've been living under a rock the last week, when you hear a reference or see a reference to Penn State University or the Nittany Lions, you think about this scandal, this sexual scandal that has rocked not only that university, but has really rocked our nation. Because the fact of the matter is that on November 5th, former Penn State defensive coordinator Jerry Sandusky was charged with sexually abusing eight boys following a grand jury investigation that also led to charges against two university officials. Athletic director Tim Curley and a vice president Gary Schultz are accused of perjury and failing to report suspected child abuse. Both have stepped down from their posts. And then also, the Penn State University Board of Trustees a few days ago fired head football coach Joe Paterno, as well as school president Graham Spanier. The incident that has occurred has not only affected this school, which has had a reputation for not only being a very fine academic institution, not only being a major sports powerhouse throughout the years, but also and especially due to the influence of the head football coach, Joe Paterno, an institution that has been noted for its emphasis upon moral and ethical character. And that's the reason why this kind of alleged events, and so many of these things are not disputed. This kind of report is absolutely just shocking and mind-boggling. And I want to talk with you this morning for a few minutes about some lessons that I think can be learned from this. And as I think about this incident, of course, the sexual abuse is reprehensible. So many things about this incident are just absolutely disgusting. But the thing that strikes me most of all, that I think we can learn from, the thing that is so striking to me about this is how many people over a decade of time, at least, knew that something was amiss, could have done something to stop what was happening, could have done at least more than what they did, and yet they didn't do it. Edmund Burke, the noted 17th century political philosopher, is credited with this famous quotation: "All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing." And I want you to think for a few minutes about that point. I think he's absolutely right. All that evil really requires is not a lot of people who are actively engaged in that evil, and to get more and more people to engage in that evil. That's really not what evil needs to triumph. All evil needs to triumph is for the good men to just sit back and do nothing about it. And not put a stop to it. And not say anything about it. For whatever reasons they may have, that's really all evil needs to win. So I want us to talk this morning a little bit about this. I want to start out this morning by saying to you that you don't have to engage in evil to be a participant in it. And I think this is an important lesson that we can learn. In fact, the Bible teaches this point in 2 John, verses 10 and 11, that little letter says this: if anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house and do not give him a greeting, for the one who gives him a greeting participates in his evil deeds. John is here talking about those who were false teachers, who were knowingly departing from that apostolic doctrine, and they would make their travels and go to various cities, and here are Christians who might take them into their home and give them lodging, and that would be something that Christians would normally do and show their hospitality. And yet he says, when you bring them into your house, when you engage in that and give them lodging or give them a place where they can then teach their doctrine that is false, you really are a participant in that. When you give them a greeting and bid them God's blessings, that implies you're accepting them and what their teaching is. It may be that you yourself never teach that false doctrine. Even though you've not engaging in that, you participate in the spread of false teaching by enabling those who do. So that's one example of the fact that you don't have to engage in something that is wrong in order to participate in it in a very real sense. Or think about 1 Corinthians 5, verses 1 and 2, where there the Apostle Paul talks about that church at Corinth. He says it's actually reported that there is immorality among you, and an immorality of such a kind as does not exist even among the Gentiles, that someone has his father's wife. And you have become arrogant and have not mourned instead, in order that the one who had done this deed might be removed from your midst. And Paul goes on to talk about in the rest of this chapter that what the Corinthian church had failed to do in their arrogance was address that problem of the incestuous man in their midst. And they already should have done that, but they did nothing. And they just tolerated that. And tolerated one among them who was engaging in that overt, blatant, immoral behavior, living with his stepmother, apparently. And they just tolerated that. They weren't actually engaged in immorality themselves, but they were a participant in all that because they enabled that man in his immoral behavior. And Paul condemns them for it. Or think, if you will, about the prophecy of Obadiah. It's an obscure Old Testament book. People don't tend to read it very much. It's that prophecy, that oracle against Edom. He says this: because of violence to your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame. Talking about how the Babylonians came in and devastated and so mistreated the people of Judah, and the people of Edom just stood by and did nothing to help their brethren. And so he goes on to say this: on the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gate and cast lots for Jerusalem, you too were as one of them. Because they just stood by and allowed all sorts of atrocities to be perpetrated upon people. And they could have done something to stop it. And every moral fiber in our being as human beings would call upon us to do something to help those who are being unjustly treated. And yet, the Edomites just did nothing. They were aloof. They stood by aloof. And the prophet says, therefore, you too were as one of those who were perpetrating those actions. Or consider this statement, Proverbs 16, verse 30. He who compresses his lips brings evil to pass. Do you see the point that the sage is making there? He who compresses his lips, who keeps his mouth shut, who doesn't talk, who doesn't tell, who doesn't speak out against that which is wrong, that person just brings evil to pass. But he's not the one actually engaging in that. But the wise sage says, well, in a sense, yes, he is. Because he brings it to pass because he keeps his mouth shut. And how many times throughout human history Have there been occasions where evil is allowed to just be propagated because here are the good people, supposedly, who just stand by and don't do anything? Hitler's final solution for the so-called Jewish problem, eradicating all of those Jews, ultimately 6 million Jews, and yet the world at that time, yes, it did know something was going on. Yes, it did know. Now, people didn't know the extremeness of that final solution. People never dreamed that that would be what Hitler would do, but they knew good and well that those Jews were being persecuted just because they were Jews. And nation after nation after nation, including our own, by the way, and religious institution after religious institution stood by and said nothing and did nothing, and businesses engaged in business dealings with all of those who were involved with the Nazis, knowing that something amiss was going on. And it was a true travesty. Or do you recall a few years ago where the story broke? In fact, it's broken on several occasions, but especially a few years ago, where the scandal that erupted within the Roman Catholic Church, because here were so many instances of priests who were in the position to be with young boys and sexually molesting boys and sexually molesting children. And what did the Catholic Church do? It really did virtually nothing. Kept a lid on it. Didn't want anyone to find out, have to protect the church. So what would they do? Well, they'd just take a priest and move him from that parish to some other parish. And all that did was just give opportunity for a whole new set of victims. There's been a lot of scandals like that throughout human history. This scandal at Penn State is just another example of this, where supposedly good people just stand by and don't do anything and don't say anything, and so evil is just allowed to just continue. When good men do nothing, what's the result? What's the result when good men do nothing? Well, first of all, sin goes on unchecked. I think when you look at 1 Samuel chapter 3, there is a marvelous illustration of this when you look at Eli the high priest. You recall the situation that's talked about in 1 Samuel, actually going all the way back to 1 Samuel chapters 1 and 2. But it all comes to a head in 1 Samuel chapter 3. Because here what you have is then that oracle that God pronounces upon the house of Eli. And look at 1 Samuel chapter 3 and I'll start with verse 11. And the Lord said to Samuel, "Behold, I'm about to do a thing in Israel at which both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. In that day I will carry out against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. For I have told him that I'm about to judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse on themselves, and he did not rebuke them." Or some versions render it, "and he did not restrain them." Do you know what the text is talking about? It's made very clear back in chapter 2 of 1 Samuel. Here was Eli, the high priest, in charge of the sanctuary of Yahweh. His sons are also priests. The people would come to that sanctuary in order for the priest to then administer those sacrifices. What would those priests do? Well, several things. They would first of all steal some of that meat that belonged to the worshiper according to God's law. They stole that for themselves. That wasn't the only thing, though. They even began to steal some of that meat that really, according to the law of Moses, was to be sacrificed and given to God. Well, they wanted it for themselves, so they stole God's portion. And as if that wasn't even enough, some of those young women that would come to the sanctuary of God, they had sexual intercourse with them in the environs of the temple of God itself. And here God pronounces judgment upon Eli and his house, and he says, "Eli, your branch of that Aaronic lineage has become a disgrace. And basically what God is saying is, I'm going to take the high priesthood from your branch of the line of Aaron and switch it to another branch in the line of Aaron. And that's ultimately what happened. And it was given to the line of Aaron through Zadok. But notice the text here says that the reason why God was pronouncing this judgment upon Eli and his house is because Eli knew. And he didn't do anything about it. He didn't restrain his sons. Now really what to me strikes me about this incident, if you read it carefully, chapters 1, 2, and 3 of 1 Samuel, what's striking to me is, and you can almost even in your mind see Eli wanting to give this rebuttal to what the Lord was saying. In chapter 2, Eli does rebuke his sons. Yes, he does. He goes to him and says, what is this I hear? What's the rumor that I hear? He doesn't know everything that is going on, but he's heard things. What is this that I hear? This is not good. And his sons didn't listen to him. He did rebuke them. But what's the prophecy mean in chapter 3 when God says, you did not rebuke, you did not restrain your sons? What's the point of all that? God is saying, you didn't do enough. What you say that you did address the problem, it wasn't enough. And as far as God was concerned, you, the high priest, the one in charge of this, who should have done something about this, should have investigated further, should have put a stop to this, even though these were people who were your own sons and very close to you, you should have done something about it, and you didn't. And as a result of that, God says, I'm bringing judgment upon your house, Eli. When good men do nothing, sin just goes unchecked. That's the reason why in Ephesians 5, verse 11, there Paul says this, do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. Even expose them. You know, I know this is a hard lesson for us to teach our children, especially young children. We're trying to teach them to not, you know, you always try to teach your kids not to tattle. And then, you know, the terminology changes as you get older, you know. Then it's, you don't rat on somebody, you know. And I don't know, the terminology may change later the older you get. I don't even know what the current lingo might be to talk about that. But that's one thing people are so worried about, young people are so worried about. But there comes a time when you've got to say something. It's that egregious. It's that big of a problem. And when the good people just sit back and don't say anything, it just allows that wickedness to continue. It's not good for the ones who are engaging in it. It's not good for other people either. Paul says, don't participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. Shine that light upon what's being done in the darkness. Somebody needs to. When good men do nothing, the weak continue to be oppressed. You know, that's the problem with sinfulness. If it were true, what we so often try to delude ourselves into thinking, that sinfulness will only affect me, what I do, it's only going to affect me. If that were true, it would still demand that people who know about our sinfulness do something to try to bring that to light to help us. But what makes sinfulness so much worse is that in nearly every case, your sin, my sin, the other guy's sin, it doesn't just affect them, it affects all sorts of other people. And so often when sin is committed, there are weak people who are harmed by that. There are poor people who are oppressed by all of that. Isaiah addressed that problem in his day. Isaiah 1, verse 23. He was describing how it was in his nation. Everyone loves a bribe and chases after rewards. They do not defend the orphan, nor does the widow's plea come before them. Widows and orphans and poor people in the Old Testament, those are almost buzzwords, just key words that just describe those who are the underprivileged, those who are weak, those who can't help themselves, those who are easily mistreated and taken advantage of. And so Isaiah talks about how what people are concerned about is the reward that they get if they just ignore that problem that that widow was having, that that poor orphan is having. Just ignore that because I'm concerned about me and what I can get. Jeremiah talked about the same thing. Jeremiah 5, verse 28. They do not plead the cause of the orphan, that they may prosper, and they do not defend the rights of the poor. This has been a perennial problem among human beings, where those who are weak and afflicted, they continue to be afflicted because the good people who could do something about it, they don't do anything. They're concerned about something else. When good men do nothing, the weak are oppressed. Here's the question we need to think about. Cain voiced it in the very beginning. Am I my brother's keeper? Do I really have some responsibility to my fellow man? And sometimes we like to delude ourselves into thinking, well, no, I don't. But if there's anything the Bible is trying to get us to see, that as a human being made in the image of God, we are not simply an individual. And we cannot think of ourselves simply as an individual. It's not simply about me. I am part of a community. I am part of a community of human beings made in the image of God. And God is my Father, and these are my brethren. And there is a sense in which, yes, we are our brother's keeper. We do have a responsibility there. And we need to understand that. And so when good men just sit back and do nothing, the weak who need help, they're oppressed and they continue to be oppressed, and there's more people who are oppressed. And that's the problem. Let me ask this question. Why do good men do that? Why do good men sit back and do nothing, say nothing? In this recent case in Penn State and in so many other sundry cases where this happens, why? Sometimes the reason is just real simple. It's just selfishness. And we looked at that just a moment ago. Sometimes I don't want to help this situation here, what somebody else is going through, because I'm concerned about me and I want something here for me. And sometimes if I involve myself with that over there, well, I might risk not getting what I want. And so that's what people are concerned about. It's all about self. And God hates that kind of thing. But sometimes that's the reason why good men do nothing. Sometimes the reason why good men do nothing is because they don't want to get involved. It springs from that selfishness. It's a particular form that that selfishness takes. How many times do the police investigating some crime have difficulty getting witnesses to come forward and to talk about what they saw because, oh, I don't want to get involved? How many times do people not want to testify because, well, I don't want to get involved? All sorts of reasons why we focus in upon ourselves and we don't want to involve ourselves. But the problem with that kind of thinking is that that person is our brother. He's made in God's image too. God loves that child as much as he loves us. So how can we just look at God's children who are in need and we just don't get involved? You can't have that kind of attitude. When there are people who are being afflicted. In fact, may I even say this? It is astounding to me when you read the grand jury report of what recently came to light at Penn State, how many people observed on different occasions these acts being perpetrated at that moment upon that child at that moment, and the person witnessing that didn't do anything at the moment to stop it. Maybe was upset by it, sickened by it, but could have stopped it from happening to that child at that moment and didn't get involved. And in our cowardice, that's what we do. I don't want to involve myself. Somebody's being hurt. Well, I might get some repercussion. I might get hurt, so I don't involve myself. And it's nothing but a cowardly kind of selfish act. And then even later, so often people don't want to get involved. Sometimes good men do nothing because they're trying to protect reputations. That's what we're concerned about. Got to protect reputations. Got to protect the reputation of maybe an institution that's had such a fine reputation. So much money that comes in. All these kinds of accolades. You don't want to mar that reputation. That can happen. That kind of mindset can just afflict people where that preserving of the reputation is more important to them than those who are being sinned against, those who are being afflicted. And it's not just universities, and it's not just colleges that sometimes can be more concerned about their reputation instead of doing the right thing for this individual. I've seen it in the Lord's church. Where there are things that are going on and people don't want to say anything because, well, in fact, we even have kind of convinced ourselves that I don't know where we got this idea. When Christians sin and we make a big deal about that, he's brought reproach upon the church. That's not the phraseology the Bible uses. That's not the emphasis the Bible uses. When a Christian sins, he brings reproach upon God. It's not an issue of, well, the church somehow, its reputation in the community. Oh, yes, that may happen, but that's not the big concern. And yet so often in our minds, that's kind of what we think about. I've known people in churches, that's why they've kept a lid on something and they've allowed the sin to continue because they didn't want our church in the community to get some bad reputation. And we delude ourselves with that kind of logic. That's not God's attitude about things. So then the weak and oppressed suffer and the sin continues and we think that's what God wants. We delude ourselves. It's not about to protect reputations. And yet so often that's why good men stand by and do nothing. And sometimes it's because there's some good that we want to accomplish, that we think is going to be accomplished, some greater good. And again, that kind of thing is just a rationalization where we think, well, you know, if I can somehow just keep the lid on this, well, you know, then maybe there's going to be something good over here that will occur with such and such. And so all we do is just rationalize sitting back and doing nothing. And not putting a stop to that evil, not exposing that which needs to be exposed. Sometimes there's misplaced loyalty. Sometimes that's our problem. Misplaced loyalty. Sometimes, well, but I'm friends with this person who's committing this sin, and I'm friends with that person. Or maybe it's my relative. Well, so what do? We then try to protect it. Maybe it's my spouse. And so we keep a lid on that. And so the sin just continues, and it never is addressed, and then other people are harmed, and so we just keep a lid on that because, well, this is my family member and we're trying to protect them, and we've got a misplaced kind of loyalty. You never are helping somebody who is engaging in sinful behavior. You're never helping them by keeping a lid on it out of loyalty to them. You're not helping them. And you're sure not helping the other people that they're sinning against. And we delude ourselves. Oh, well, I'm just being loyal to this person. That's not the way God's people need to think. That's not the way the Bible calls upon us to think. God doesn't show partiality in his judgment. How many times has God emphasized that point? That's why judgment, as far as God is concerned, it starts where? It starts in God's house. It's not a matter of, well, I'm loyal to this person because, in fact, This is my brother in Christ. And how many times do people have a misplaced loyalty about that? Well, he's a fellow Christian, so I don't want to reveal something. That's not the way that we need to think. If there's somebody there who's had some problem and you're close with that person and they're engaged in sin, then you put a stop to it. You go to that person, you do whatever you can do to put a stop to that. But if it doesn't work and they're still engaging in that, then you need to tell somebody else to get somebody else along. That's exactly what Jesus was talking about in Matthew chapter 18. If you go to your brother in private, doesn't work, well then you take two or three with you. That doesn't work, then bring it to the whole church. I mean, that's the process. You do whatever you can do. And certainly you don't need to think as some kind of a misplaced loyalty concept that I'll just keep my mouth shut and not say anything and just allow it to continue. If you do that, you're as guilty as the person who's engaging in it. God does not want us to be enablers, folks. He doesn't want his people to be enablers of sinful behavior. And I'll tell you one final thing. Sometimes good men do nothing because they misconstrue Scripture. And they think that how they're handling it is in accordance with what the Scripture teaches. I'll tell you what I mean. I've known firsthand cases of this. I don't know how many times I've heard brethren who have been faced with some Christian who was a perpetrator of a crime against somebody else, where the authorities need to be told, where the person needs to be reported to the authorities. And I've heard Christians, oh no, you can't do that because, well, 1 Corinthians 6 says that a brother is not supposed to go to law court against a brother, and so people have taken that verse, plucked it out of context. I've known people, there has been criminal action, criminal behavior, unrepented of, still going on within the congregation, and of a sexual abuse nature and other things, and those things aren't reported. And there, I've had elders say this to me when I've been called and they've asked for my advice on, we've got a situation where there's a child that's been sexually molested, and you need to call the authorities. You have to do that. Oh, well, but he's a Christian, so we don't want to violate 1 Corinthians 6. 1 Corinthians 6 is talking about a lawsuit. I'm talking about a criminal action. I'm talking about not going to a pagan judge when you have a lawsuit. You can't get along with your neighbor and get this rectified. That's what Paul's talking about. Nowhere does the Bible ever teach that somehow if it's a Christian, well then you don't report that to the authorities. That's absolutely wrong. In fact, as Christians, we're the ones who are supposed to be abiding by the laws of the land and showing people that we're concerned about righteousness. Now, yes, we want to then help that person who's guilty of that crime and help them in every way possible as a Christian. That's what we should do. But absolutely we are misguided in our thinking if we somehow think that because we're a Christian, the Bible is teaching us to not report this criminal behavior to the authorities. That's not what 1 Corinthians 6 is talking about. So good men stand by and just do nothing. Or don't do enough. Don't do enough. I leave you with these words this morning. Obadiah said it so clearly. On the day that you stood aloof, you too were as one of them. When you stood by aloof and did nothing, and you saw the sinful behavior that was going on, and you did nothing, you're as one of them. So, this is a lesson that, frankly, I think that a lot of people in our world right now are going to be talking about. The whole idea of good people standing by and doing nothing and allowing evil to then gain the victory. I think even people in the world are going to be, and already have been, talking about that problem. And that's why I wanted to address that to us today and look at what the Bible has to teach about this, because absolutely the Bible is trying to get us to see as God's people a proper, clear way for us to view these things. And so I urge all of us to think carefully about these things and to not allow ourselves to rationalize away our responsibility to address a problem that is there. And God's looking over our shoulder. And are we doing what we need to do? And that's the question that we need to ask ourselves. On the day that you stood aloof, you too were as one of them. Let that not be said of us. Thank you for listening to me this morning. I hope these things will be of help to us, maybe thought-provoking, maybe challenging. If there's someone here this morning who needs to respond to the gospel of Jesus Christ, we sure would like to help you. Anything we can do to help you make your life right with God, let that be known, won't you, while together we stand and sing this song of encouragement.